Thank you very much for having me and giving me the opportunity to speak. I watched David's talk before when I was preparing mine, and you sure had a very good attendance. So.
Had one fewer program.
There were three programs then.
I will not talk very much about microscopy in the common sense, because what I'm going to try to sell to you is a very different kind of microscopy, but I think it has very interesting potential, and no matter how difficult it looks, I always tell myself that it would have been irresponsible not to try it, and as a scientist, I should. And there is a great deal of quantum control, for sure, but it's a very simple quantum control compared to what David was talking about. And what is very nice is that it works, probably because it is very simple and it's not really quantum, it's completely classical. I may touch upon it a little bit. Now here I have given you the characteristic scales that we are going to talk about. I will be talking about atoms and molecules, mostly about molecules interacting with laser fields. So the energies to keep in mind are here. The atomic unit of energy is 27 eV, and that's twice the ionization potential of the hydrogen atom. The corresponding time scales, one atomic unit of time is 24 arcseconds, and if we think about classical picture of a Bohr atom, it takes an electron about 150 arcseconds to orbit the nucleus on the first Bohr orbit. So these are the characteristic time scales for the electrons. Now the lasers we're going to talk about, these are the characteristic time scales, laser cycle for the favorite near-infrared laser operating at 800 nanometers is about 2.6 femtoseconds. There's absolutely no reason why we pick this wavelength, other than the fact that experimentalists usually do their experiments with this laser. And it's a purely practical, pragmatic reason. This laser works day in and day out, very, very stable for 5, 6, 7 days in a row, and you can do a lot of very neat experiments when you have high repetition rate, excellent control over the pulses, very high stability of the source. So this is really why originally most of the experiments have been done at this wavelength, but we're now moving to different wavelengths. However, this is a very, very useful time scale to keep in mind. Now, as for the fields, electric fields that we need to keep in mind, this is the electric field, the atomic unit. This is the field between a proton and an electron on the first Bohr orbit. Again, it's 50 volts per angstrom, roughly. Another very important figure to keep in mind is the external electric field that it takes to suppress the barrier that binds an electron, the Coulomb barrier, that binds an electron on the first Bohr orbit below the binding energy of the ground state. So what I have sketched here is Coulomb potential in one dimension. It's this red or pink picture, pink curve. Now, I'm adding to this potential a constant electric field acting on an electron. So it's minus 1 over x minus fx. That's the white curve. And here sits my ground state. So it takes only 3 volts per angstrom, only, to suppress the barrier below the binding energy of the ground state in hydrogen. These fields are trivial to create in the lab or with a tabletop laser source at this wavelength. So the kinds of the fields that we can apply to our molecules and atoms are comparable to the fields, electrostatic fields that bind the electrons in atoms. And therefore, if we can manipulate these pulses, we can think about controlling electron motion. And that's really the connection to control. But as far as I can see, at least in this picture, it's a purely classical control. We have external forces that are comparable to the internal forces. We shape these external forces essentially at our will, and we see what happens. Now, I pointed out that the laser cycle is 2.6 femtoseconds, so let me draw you one oscillation of the laser field. This is supposed to be a perfect cosine. I think it is. But not complete. So 2.6 femtoseconds for 800 nanometers, this is near infrared, is this time scale. But of course, it's not the whole story. I have just told you that we also have to think about the fields. So now the electric field that we create changes from zero to maximum. No field, 3 volts per angstrom, roughly, in about 650 attoseconds. So, of course, the time scale is still very long compared to the atomic unit, but also think about the gradient, how quickly we ramp the field. All right, so this is the picture. This is the setup. Now the microscopy or the camera, high-speed photography camera that I will be talking about, really is something that looks spectacular already when you just do an experiment without even thinking about the information that is contained in your observation. So here is the experiment. You take lots of molecules. This could be in a jet, inside the fiber, sometimes even in a cell. You send laser field incident on this gas of molecules. Usually the experiments are done in a jet inside the vacuum chamber. So this is my 800 nanometers. And what these guys emit when they're hit by the fields of the strengths just around this value, usually below, because you don't want to create plasma. So we're trying to work slightly below this field strengths. Drive our system strong, but not strong enough to completely blow it apart. And gas of molecules emits radiation. These are harmonics of the incident field. Normally, in nonlinear optics, you would expect to see the third harmonic, the fifth harmonic, and that's about it. The seventh, if you really crank up the intensity. Well, here they go from third to, well, 133rd, let's say, which is amazing. And this is how they look. Now, in what follows, I won't be dealing with these extreme regimes. But if you want, you can do it. So here is my harmonic number, N. This is the harmonic yield. What I see usually is a very, very long spectrum that goes all the way from third to, let's say, let me scale this down to 41st, because this happens to be the last harmonic I looked at this morning. And then they die very quickly. And this is called the plateau. And this is called the cutoff. Because mostly, we're talking about spectrum which consists of odd harmonics, third, fifth, seventh, 41st. Now, let's just look at this. spectrum and think about it for a while. What it tells us? Well, we started with the laser cycle that's about 2.6 femtoseconds long, and our pulses are, let's say, 30 femtoseconds. We end up with coherent radiation that covers the bandwidth of, in this particular case, 60 to 70 eV. Now, this is all coherent light, which is a response, nonlinear response of our system. So embedded in this is a time resolution, which is 1 divided by the bandwidth of the spectrum that we're looking at. Now, I'm not trying to say that this is exactly the time resolution we're going to get, but in principle, there is a potential for the time resolution, which is 1 divided by 70 eV. So let me go now to my atomic unit. It's 27 eV. So we're talking about something like delta omega on the order of 2 to 3 atomic units. And the time resolution, delta t, which is 1 divided by delta omega, maybe pi, I don't know. We can vote whether we should put pi here or not. I think I should put pi here, because if I don't, I'll get a scary good resolution. So this is about 1 atomic unit, and that is 24 attoseconds. So this radiation is telling us something about the molecules on the time scale of 24 attoseconds, which is the time scale of the electronic response. So now, naturally, when we ask the question, who the hell is responsible for this response? Must be electrons. Nuclei are too slow. Then let me ask you, what about spatial resolution? I claimed in the title of the talk that I'll be talking about spatial and temporal resolution. Temporal, we already have. Where is spatial resolution coming from?
70 eV.
Right. But you're not allowed to answer that question because you know the answer. But yes, that is the answer. 70 eV, and this, of course, must have something to do with the electrons. These are the guys responsible for the response. So we're talking about electrons that are having energies around 70 eV, which means that their de Broglie wavelength is about 1 angstrom, which is exactly what I claim. So my temporal resolution is somewhere potentially 24 attoseconds. The spatial resolution is determined by the de Broglie wavelength of the electrons, and this is about 1 angstrom, more 2 angstroms, give or take. Few questions that you may want to ask at this point is, can we do better? Can we go from 41st to actually 133rd? Can we go to 200, 300 harmonic lines? The answer is yes. In fact, people are doing it right now. And all it takes, as you will learn very soon, is change the favorite wavelength and go slightly deeper into the infrared.
But this is in the same sense that when we do particle physics collider experiments.
Yes.
We indeed probe to sub-10 to the minus 18 centimeters and times of 10 to the minus 28.
I wouldn't claim I know how you do your experiments, but if you say so, yes. what I really want to show is that not only there is potential information hidden in this response, if you work at it, if you think hard, you can dig it out. It is not a very easy job, and you can lose a lot of hair trying to do it, because you pull your hair since it never works. But still, we have learned something, and this is what I want to share. Now, the process that is responsible for this response is ionization. A And again, if you think about it, in retrospect, it's a trivial matter. If you want an electron to gain something like 60 or 70 eV of energy, and your binding energy is on the scale of 10 or 15 eV, well, it got to be free, this electron. But of course, it starts bound. So what is happening here is the following simple picture. And now again, I go back to this plot, and I want you to imagine what happens inside the laser cycle and how the potential changes from the pink to the white inside the laser cycle. So to do it, I will draw this picture again. Here is my cosine wave. At this point in time, we have no field, and an electron sitting in an atom feels unperturbed potential. Now, 650 attoseconds later, at this point, we've got a bias. We have put a tremendous voltage against our system, and now the wave function that was sitting in the ground state is feeling that there is not much of a barrier keeping it inside. So now a part of the wave function can tunnel. Doesn't have to be a big piece. In fact, it's nice to do experiments when this piece is something like 1% only. Otherwise, there are many other problems that we run into. So this happens around the peak of the field, somewhere around here. What happens next? What happens next is a story which I don't even know how to describe. I think that Virgin Becker, who unfortunately is not here, has summarized it the best in 1995 and 1996 when he finally said light at the end of the tunnel. We're dealing with very, very strong fields, highly non-perturbative response of a system. We used to think in terms of absorption of many, many photons. We've got photons, by the way, I should have given you the scale here. For 800 nanometers, the laser photon is something like 1.55 eV. So it takes quite a few photons to go up, and it takes even more photons to create this emission. So we used to think in terms of highly non-perturbative, multi-photon response, which is true. And then came a giant called Paul Corkum, who said, well, you know, let's think about this classically. And to be honest and fair, there has been another giant. There is another giant who is unrecognized in the field, unfortunately, Misha Kuchiev in Australia, who understood this in quantum terms even before Paul and published the corresponding paper. But it was Paul who came up with the simple classical picture. He said, look, a little piece of this wave function tunnels out. And of course, this wave packet starts to slide down the hill. But the hill is not static. At this point in time, we again, the potential looks like this. And at this point in time, the hill has reversed. So now the wave packet that's been sliding down is beginning to feel the force that is pushing it back. And there is a chance that this wave packet is going to come back and hit the parent ion. And it is this recollision that I will describe and discuss. And it is I will show to you that this recollision is responsible for the harmonic generation. And I will try to tell you how much information about the dynamics inside the molecule or inside the atom we can gain from looking at the spectrum. I will start with the classical picture. I hope that I will end up with entangled wave packets and entanglement between the electron and the hole left in the molecule, and what can we learn about the hole left in the molecule. But let me begin with the classical picture. If you want to object to me using classical language, do it now. Nobody objects.
The workshop is called quantum control.
Right. but I told during one of the panel sessions that quantum control has a lot of classical in it, and in this particular case there is. There is a good reason why we can use classical language, because if we think about the action, the action accumulated by the electron which is moving in this field is very, very large. And it's this very large value of action that allows us to use saddle point analysis of the quantum mechanical integrals and dig out the simple classical trajectories. I will not do it, even though I would love to, because this is a theory talk, but I won't. No saddle point analysis today. All right. Let me try to solve this problem classically, and let me ask the question, what is the energy of electron when it comes back, if it comes back, and hits the parent atom or a parent molecule? And what I'm going to do is write second Newton law, x double dot times the mass of electron is f cosine omega t. You should object that I have omitted the Coulomb potential, and I agree that this is a major crime, but I will still do it, just because I want to get very simple analytical formulas. If the electron tunnels out here, clearly its velocity is equal to zero, and therefore my initial condition, x dot, at some moment in time when it shows up, is zero. And what I want to know is whether this guy is going to come back or not. If it comes back, then obviously x of t is the moment of return, has to be equal to x of t zero. And this is all I need to solve this very simple system of equations.
The fact that the Coulomb potential helps you reduce this to a one-dimensional problem.
Even without the Coulomb potential, it is still a three-dimensional problem. But it helps me. In that case, it separates. It separates in the trajectories, but actually not in the initial conditions. But that's a different story. Neglecting the Coulomb potential helps me integrate cosine twice. I think this is really what I want. But what you will see is that the results we get from such a tremendously simple model are remarkably close to what we observe in the experiment. There is a reason why it is not silly to neglect the Coulomb potential. Here, of course, it is strong. But as the electron is moving away, and I will give you the scale, the Coulomb potential becomes weak. Okay, so let me integrate this equation. So what do I want? I want to know what is the energy or the velocity of the electron at this moment in time when the coordinate is equal to the initial coordinate. So let's do that. This is something I can actually do on the board. So I integrate this once, it's f over omega, mass is 1, so I erase it. Sine omega t minus sine omega t 0. So I have satisfied my initial condition. Now x of t would be, now I have to integrate sine, I will get cosine with a minus sign. I will have to, sorry, this is delta x. Delta x is the difference between x of t and x of t zero. I don't want to carry this constant with me. So this is f over omega squared cosine omega to 0. So far I have made sure that delta x from integrating this term is equal to 0 at t0. Now I have the constant term which I have to integrate, and that gives me f over omega sine omega t0 t minus t0. And just for convenience, I'm going to put here omega squared, and I'm going to multiply it with omega. And if I have not lost you at this point, then I'm doing well, because this is really the hardest math that you will see. Now, what I want to do is solve this equation. I want to find out when the electron is coming back, if at all. Therefore, I have to set this to 0. Now, this is nice. I can cross the amplitude of oscillations, which is f divided by omega squared. And by the way, let me just point out that for the characteristic frequencies and the strengths of the field, this amplitude is something like 20 angstroms. So indeed, we pull the electron really far away, and then we smack it back, if at all. Now, how do we solve this transcendental equation? Well, all we need to do is take this cosine with the minus and put it on the right-hand side with the plus. So what I have is cosine omega t 0 minus sine omega t 0 times omega t minus omega t 0 equals to cosine omega t. And I solve it graphically. So for the third time today, I draw the cosine. So this is the right-hand side. It's cosine. Along the axis is omega t. What stands on the left is a straight line. Omega t minus omega t 0 is a straight line. Minus sine is the slope, which is just the tangent to the cosine. Cosine omega t 0 is the starting value right here. So if I start at omega t 0, I have to draw a tangent, and I hit, in this particular case, somewhere around here. So this is my return point. If I have a solution, the electron comes back. Clearly, you can see that if the electron shows up at the peak of the field, it still can. If it shows up before the peak of the field, it never will come back. So these are the kinds of trajectories we have in mind. And now, knowing the initial moment of time, knowing the moment of return, omega t return, I can plot the energy of the returning electron as a function of this moment in time.
It doesn't need to meet all the two curves, the axis and the cosine, right? Or does it always meet the tangent?
The tangent meets the cosine only if this moment is after the maximum. If the moment is before the maximum, it goes up. And it, of course, it crosses the cosine, but that's the times before the ionization, so that is meaningless.
You mean there are three solutions?
I see right now two. One, two, but yes, indeed, there could be more. You must be a mathematician. Yeah, there could be plenty. Depending on exactly when we begin, we could have return number one, return number two. And in fact, if we go here, we can have infinitely many returns. Experimentalists are clever people, and this is something I I mean, it's really, one has to admire it. They figured out how to do experiments so that they only look at the first return and they don't observe anything related to higher order returns. That's another story. Okay. So now I'm going to plot the energy. And let me also do it interactively so that you can catch me if I tell you something stupid. Suppose that I start my trajectory right at this point. Well, clearly you can see it comes back at the same point in time, and there is no time to gain any energy. So I start at zero. This is energy. This is omega t return. Now, if I start here, then the return is here, but energy at the moment of return will again be equal to zero, classically, simply because we take the exact same time to accelerate the electron away. Then at this point, we slow it down completely. This part of the curve undoes this part. Then we accelerate it towards the ion, and then we slow it down completely to the full stop at this point in time. So now we've got two zeros, and I think, as everybody would expect, we must have a maximum in between, because the energy must be positive, so it cannot go down. This maximum is, in fact, just right around here. It's a bit earlier than that. And so let me put here pi over 2 pi, 3 pi over 2, roughly. And we can also ask, what is the maximum value? And it is after we ask this question and we calculate the answer that one begins to believe the classical model. The answer comes out remarkably as the following: 3.17, few more digits after that, times the average energy of electron oscillations in the field. And the average energy of electron oscillations in the field is this. So it's charge squared, electric field squared, frequency of the laser field squared, and the mass of the electron. Why do we believe this? Because then we take this number and we compare it to experimental observations. And that is precisely where the harmonic spectrum drops, like a rock. In fact, it's slightly more delicate than that, because this is just the energy of the electron in the continuum as it comes back. But the harmonic emission comes actually from recombination to the original state. So what we really have is an atom where we have a part of the wave function still bound, a wave packet that's coming back. And what one has to calculate, and in this case, really quantum mechanically, one has to calculate the induced dipole created by the laser field between these two pieces of the wave function. So the induced dipole is, it's very simply, it is psi d psi, where psi is the time-dependent wave function. This wave function has two pieces, bound part and continuum part, psi bound plus psi continuum, d psi bound plus psi continuum. And now we put, now we just select all the terms. I will write them down. We have psi bound d psi continuum. This is the piece we are really interested in. It is the recombination of the continuum wave packet back into the bound part. plus psi continuum d psi bound. This is the complex conjugated to it. And then there are two pieces which we're not terribly interested in. Psi bound d psi bound. This is the dipole induced in the bound electron. It does not oscillate with these huge energies because it bound electron does not have that much energy. And then there is another piece which is also not terribly exciting. Psi continuum, d psi continuum. These are the free spontaneous transitions. They're extraordinarily weak. So this really is the most important piece. And if we want to ask the question, what photons should we detect as a result of the transition from the continuum part to the bound part? Well, the answer is very simple. The energy conservation law tells me that the energy of the emitted photon should be the energy of the returning electron, which is the distance from here to here, plus the binding energy, which is the distance from here to here, plus the binding energy, which is IP. So, and indeed, in the harmonic experiments, the cutoff is observed around 3.17 UP plus IP. Sorry, UP is this average energy of the electron oscillations. That's this guy. Okay, so at this point in time, we begin to believe that the classical picture is correct. And I have about 15 minutes left. So what I will do is I will go very, very quickly through another check of this classical picture, which I personally find extremely nice. And then I will tell you what do we learn.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I mean, that 3.17 number is calculated entirely classically.
Yes.
And you're saying experimentally you see that to like three significant figures?
No, experimentally you see something like 3.2. And there are so many things that go into the experiment that really 3.17 is not terribly meaningful. 3.2 is probably a much better number. Okay. So very quickly, let me give you another check of this picture. And this is the work that I actually like very much because for two reasons. One, it is one of the papers I'm most proud of, and it so happens that the best papers I ever write go through about 12 referee reports. It has happened now 3 times, and these were my best papers. Secondly, is because really I think it was that experiment and that little piece of theory that made us believe completely that the picture we're talking about is correct.
So far, was it Kuchiev's picture?
No, it really is a classical picture, and Misha Kuchiev's picture was fully quantum mechanical, and it, in a way, it's more advanced. But because it was more advanced, the physics was hidden. And I think that only in retrospect, once we understood the physics, I went back to Kuchiev's paper from 88, and I said, oh, shit, he actually knew it all along. But he never expressed it in the terms of the simple classical model. Nor did he have the 3.2. His picture, and maybe I should give justice to Misha, his picture was called atomic antenna. He talked about an electron that is released by an atom, absorbs energy from the laser field as an antenna, and then dumps it or pumps it back into the atom, causing multiple ionization. And this is precisely what I will mention right now, very quickly. Because if you think about an electron that comes back with energy up to 3 of this, and this is something like 40 to 60 eV, depends on the laser parameters and so on, maybe 20 to 30 eV, you realize that this electron has to be able to knock out at least one more electron. Therefore, in conjunction with the harmonic generation, one should also see multiple ionization. And these two effects must go hand in hand. And so the experiment was to look for the simultaneous appearance and disappearance of these two effects. Yes?
It's not clear because you seem to be talking about hydrogen atom or something. It's one electron.
Right.
Where does second come from?
Suppose I now take a helium atom or a xenon atom.
Okay.
And still I have...
Hydrogen, this wouldn't work.
With hydrogen, this wouldn't work. Yes. But there are plenty of atoms around.
Okay, okay. So this picture works for most atoms?
This picture so far works for in the regime where the laser frequency is low compared to the time scale of electronic response. And therefore, we can think about this sloshing of electron back and forth and some of it leaking through. This picture seems to work for everything we have looked at so far. And actually, Tonya's work was really nice in that regard with Misha Frolov, who specifically looked carefully quantum mechanically when the full quantum mechanical analysis reveals under what conditions this classical picture and what are the required parameters. And yes, the only parameter that you need is large classical action, and large classical action means that the characteristic energy, which is this E squared F squared over 4m omega squared, times the characteristic time, which is, let's say, pi divided by omega, and that should be much larger than 1. And this really happens all the time. So the energy of electron oscillations in the field has to be much bigger than the energy of the laser photon. So as soon as the laser photon has sufficiently small energy, that works. Okay, so now let's think about how do we check that double ionization is present together with harmonic generation and they follow the exact same law. And the way to check it is very simple. If you think classically, we have two fields. Here is my atom. Let's say here is my laser field polarized along this axis, linearly polarized field, F times cosine omega t. So here is an atom, here is an electron. Let me apply a second component of the field, so make the field slightly elliptically polarized. Epsilon times F times sine omega t. And let me ask the question, what is the electron when it is liberated? What is it going to do if I have slightly elliptically polarized field? The answer is very simple. This is an additional force which is acting in that direction, and it acts like a wind which simply blows this electron away. So as I increase ellipticity, at some point, my electrons will start to miss the target. And therefore, two processes, harmonic generation and multiple ionization, should die together simultaneously as we increase ellipticity. We can calculate what ellipticity we need. For that, we actually need quantum mechanics, because we have to remember that the electron is not a point particle. It's a wave packet that spreads in lateral dimension. Or is it transverse, actually? I always mix up. In that dimension. And so if we want to kill recollision, then we want to make sure that the drift is larger than the spread. From that, it's very simple to get analytical estimates. The ellipticity that comes out is something like only 0.2. So you only need 4% in this component of the field of intensity. And then you do an experiment where you plot the signal. And this could be harmonic signal or double ionization signal as a function of ellipticity. And they all look the same. And this is 0.2. So at this point, we say, yes, it really is true. Now, I have 15 minutes, so let me tell you what can we learn from this process. How do we dig out the temporal and the spatial information that's contained in harmonic spectrum? First of all, what is this harmonic generation? So we have d of t, which is psi b psi, and I have convinced you, or at least you had no energy to resist, that it's really only this part that I should be worried about. The bound part, the and the continuum part. Let me make another crime, which is in line with neglecting the Coulomb potential. If I dare to neglect the Coulomb potential, why don't I replace my continuum with a plane wave? So I'm looking now at the Fourier transform of the dipole at a particular harmonic frequency, and let's call it n omega. So n some number. D of n omega must be something like psi bound d psi continuum, the part of it, let's call it tilde, the part of it that has the energy given by the energy conservation law, so that I'm going to emit the photon n omega.
That's assuming that psi bound isn't t dependent.
It is. This is the funnest, the most interesting part.
But you neglect that at least.
Now I don't.
But you're doing the Fourier analysis.
Yes.
Just with respect to.
Yes, yes. And so this is a very good point. In fact, there is actually, first of all, if we deal with low frequency light, then the bound electron, which has a response time of about 150 attoseconds of that sort, adjust adiabatically. So the only time scale that is here is about the laser frequency. There are some harmonics of the laser frequency, very, very few. So we tend to conveniently neglect the temporal dependence here. In fact, if you do saddle point analysis, that's a perfectly valid assumption. There is more to that point, actually. There is quite a bit more, but let me skip that. Okay. So now what I need to do, I have already done the Fourier transform. So I have selected the piece of the continuum wave function that has the right energy. What is the energy? The energy of this continuum wave function should be n omega minus ip. Then, if I want, I'll put a plane wave, ikx, or if I want to be three-dimensional, then ikx scalar product, k is square root of 2e. So each harmonic is mapped onto particular energy of the electron, which is mapped onto the wave number k, and what I have here is a Fourier transform. Psi bound d ikx dx. So by measuring harmonic amplitudes, I'm actually measuring the Fourier transform. This is a very, very crude idea. In fact, the part of the frustration of the work of a theorist is to realize that first Born approximation, which is exactly what we did, does not work at 20 V or 30 V for the returning electron. And you have to be much more sophisticated, treating scattering to actually get quantitative and not qualitative information out. And that is where you really have to be very careful about the atomic or molecular physics that you're doing. But still, the ballpark idea is here. Now, what is really nice about harmonic generation is that we can actually measure not this guy squared, which would be the Fourier transform squared. We, in fact, can measure the amplitude and the phase, because this is a field. It's the light field that's being emitted. And again, it is quite possible, and people are doing today, to characterize not only the amplitude, but also the phase of the harmonic emission. So what we actually have is a complex Fourier transform, unfortunately not with the plane waves.
Right, that, I mean, that component is the real part of this.
He changed the definitions.
The dipole moment, D, is of course always real. That is true. Every observable that you do is always real. But even the real dipole has a phase. When we do the Fourier transform, we tend to only take, let's say, positive frequency part or the negative frequency part, and we tend to look at the complex signal. The connection to it and to the experimental observation is rather trivial. Always in experiment, you observe clicks, you observe intensities, and what you want to do is to map frequency modulation of this guy onto some amplitude modulation of your signal, and then you dig out the phase. I'll leave this technicality aside. So now we can talk about the Fourier transforms and measuring complex Fourier transforms, and that in principle allows you to reconstruct the wave function, the bound wave function. And this has made a lot of noise under the name of molecular tomography. Do I personally believe molecular tomography? Not really, because the continuum is not a plane wave. Can you learn some useful information? Possibly yes. Possibly yes. But still, it's a fun thing to think about. There is actually more to it. And I want to bring you back to this graph. Because not only we're looking at the Fourier transform, at the whole range of frequencies, our energies span from nothing to 6 dV, so we have really nice Fourier transform over a very broad range. We also have time resolution. The time resolution is embedded in this picture. If you think about the energy conservation law and you ask the question, when was this harmonic N omega emitted? Well, it has been emitted when the electron had energy E given by the energy conservation law. So now I go to this plot and I put this energy E. And what do I get? I get 2 points. This is number one, this is number two. So for each harmonic, I have a specific energy. And for this energy, I have specific moments in time when this photon had to be emitted. As I said, experimentalists are clever people. They figured out how to only measure in their response the emission that corresponds to so-called short trajectories, return times between pi over 2 and 3 pi over 2, and simply not look at these guys. That will take about extra 15 minutes. I'm more than happy to stay here and explain to everybody who is interested how this actually works. It's a simple trick. But let's take on faith that we can simply erase this part of the curve. Now I have wonderful temporal resolution because I've got something like 60 eV that are being emitted at different times within one half of the laser cycle. What is my temporal resolution? The total emission time for all of my spectrum is from here to here. So this is something like pi divided by omega laser. The total energy that I'm emitting is N max, the largest energy, is the highest harmonic number times omega laser. Therefore, the time delta T per harmonic is something like this delta T divided by N max. So let me put these numbers in, pi divided by N max times omega laser. This is the largest photon energy I've got. And this is pi. N max is times omega laser is 3 times this guy. So what do I have? 4 omega squared m on top, e squared 3 F squared at the bottom. Now, this is probably the most important part of my message. Harmonic spectrum is a movie. It runs for about that long, which for the kind of lasers we're used to working with is 1 to maybe now pushing it 3 femtoseconds. But it has lots of frames. And max is the number of frames. This could be 100. Something like 100 frames squeezed into about 3 femtoseconds. The time for each frame is this time divided by the number of frames. And for the typical numbers, it comes out as something like 100 seconds. So we have spatial resolution from the Fourier transform. We have temporal resolution from this curve plus very smart experimentalists who managed to erase the back end of it. And we have recorded the movie.
So you can, in effect, measure the time dependence of the bound.
Yes. And I can measure, now, the last 5 minutes, what can I measure? I can measure the time dependence of the bound part. What I'm actually very excited about, and this is what we do with Ulia, is look at the holes that are created in the molecule upon ionization. Because if you think about it, and this is really the last thing I wanted to mention, here is my molecule, and because I'm a physicist, it has just one center and looks suspiciously like an atom. All right, let's put here in the eye. So there are all kinds of electrons whizzing around. Now we come. Where's the laser field? And we pick one electron out. Don't know which one, they're all equivalent. As we pick one electron out, it's here, we have created a hole. This hole leaves for about 1 to 2 femtoseconds, which is the time scale between ionization and recombination, when the electron comes back and recombines with the hole. But of course, it doesn't have to sit still. It can also move inside the ion. So what really this electron is doing when it's coming back, it tries to find the hole to squeeze into. And from the signal that we observe, from the minima and maxima in the signal, we can actually learn a little bit about what this hole was doing. Now, I wonder if you want me to write another formula which will prove formally that this is exactly what we can look at. Or you can take it on faith.
You have to see what you're going to see. Helpful.
What am I going to see? Or say what you want to say. All right. The continuum wave function is really not a one-electron beast. It's an entangled wave function. It is a sum of ionic states in which we can create our molecular ion or atomic ion. Let's call them psi I. These are my ionic states. And correlated to these guys are continuum wave packets, chi I, which depend on time. And so are these. If I want to be nice, I have to put antisymmetrization in front. So what I have created upon ionization is an entangled wave packet, which has a bunch of ionic states, which describe the lack of one electron.
We don't have time they're equally weighted.
No, because these chi's have different norms. These are the continuum wave packets, and they carry with them the probability of creating these ionic states. I wish them to be equally weighted. However, this is psi. What the harmonic generation does, it does a very interesting thing. Out of these wave packets, it actually only picks a particular momentum component, which is such that enables the electron to come back to the parent ion. Even though these guys could be very different for different ionic wave functions. But this difference doesn't really matter, not only because they're driven by the same strong laser field, but also because out of all momentum components, only very narrow window matters, the one that goes mostly along the field and then comes back. Everything that's going sideways is going to miss. And therefore, essentially, what the harmonic generation does, it projects this whole thing on a particular momentum component parallel to the laser polarization. Once we project this psi on a particular continuum momentum, we actually have a nice wave packet inside the ion. A is gone, sum over I, phi I, in principle is a function of time because the laser also acts on the ion, not only on the continuum electron. And here are my projections, A, P, I, which depends on time. What is this? It's nothing but the wave packet. It's the multi-electron wave packet that's been created in the ion. Recombination, really, is when this piece, P, interferes with the bound state. So the dipole D would actually be something like this. D at a particular n omega would be roughly proportional to psi bound, which is now my reference multi-electron wave function. D, the dipole operator that is going to act on the continuum wave packet or continuum state. Ionic states phi I of t and sum over all of them and p. And this p, of course, has to correspond to the energy of the emitted photon. The overlap of the n electron, well, m electron, the overlap of the m electron wave function of the neutral and m minus 1 electron wave packet in the ion is nothing but a hole. And this p, upon action of the operator d, is forced to go back into the hole. What am I going to see? Let's look at the most trivial example of only two ionic states. In this case, the wave packet is very, very simple. What we're going to see, of course, is interference of two different pathways from the ground state of the bound state to the continuum back to the bound state. So suppose that by phi I have two of them, phi 1 is the coordinate part, and it has its energy, E1 times time. Phi 2 is phi 2 of x, and it has its own energy as a function of time. Now, these two guys overlap with psi bound. This gives me a coordinate dependent part. Remember, we have one electron less here than here, so actually this should be x2 xm, x2 xm, but the phases remain. So D would have two pieces, some amplitude alpha 1, which is the recombination amplitude into the hole associated with the ionic state 1, E1t, plus alpha 2, E2 minus I, E2t. This really is what we will see. Particular times sorry, particular photon energies will give him particular times. So if I have here n omega, then here I will have n omega. Go back to this picture. Each energy corresponds to its own time. And now what I have as a function of the harmonic number, which means as a function of time, I have an interference of two terms. And what do I expect to see? Of course, what I expect to see is not a flat plateau profile, but some interference, minima and maxima. And this minima and maxima is a function of the harmonic number. Tell me about the motion of the hole between the ionization and recombination. It is not interesting, and nothing is exciting in looking at the beating of two levels in such a complicated setup. What is, however, exciting is that the position of the minima and maxima will tell me about the initial phase between these two complex amplitudes. This initial phase will tell me about the initial phases of the ionic states that I have created. This initial phase will tell me where the hole began. And so what actually we are looking at right now is when we do strong field ionization and remove an electron and leave a hole in the molecule, where is it? Is it on the side from which we removed an electron, or is it on some other opposite side, or is it in the middle? What we have learned is that possibly, depending on the ionization process, not really surprising, and also depending on the electron-electron interaction, depending on the interaction of the outgoing electron with the rest of the core, you can leave the hole in different places. And I think this is really the most exciting part of what we're doing right now, and is also the freshest part and least understood. Because really, in order to answer these questions quantitatively rather than qualitatively, we have to be very accurate about how we model the response. But the question about the shape and the location of the hole and its motion between ionization and recombination on 2 femtosecond timescale is the question that I personally find very interesting. And this is really the camera. Was at a second temporal and sub-femtosecond at a second spatial sub-femtosecond temporal resolution. Thank you.
Any more questions?
The cutoff from which you started, is it exponential? Is it,
it is exponential.
Tunneling through,
It's pretty much Gaussian. It has been erased already. It's the energy
cutoff.
Yeah. So this is the spectrum, harmonic number, yield, and somewhere here. Yes, it's exponential. And classically, it should be a step function. Quantum mechanically, it never is.
Somewhere. Somewhere. And the linear potential?
The way I see it, because I tend to think about these things classically always still, it's really not, in a way it is. This is the following. We've got our electron. It's a wave packet. It is coming back. The center hits the origin, the parent ion, with the energy of 3 times this. It passes by. The tail is still behind. And that tail, in principle, can have high energy because of the slight delay. And it can still recombine. And therefore, this really is what I think responsible for the cutoff. Also, always in quantum mechanics, you don't have to appear after tunneling with zero velocity. You can appear with positive or negative velocity. And so if you put this into the calculation, you can recover a little bit of the tail. But at this point in time, you just do the quantum calculation, you do the saddle point analysis. A theorist would tell you, my saddle point is no longer on the real time axis, it is going to the complex plane. time becomes acquires imaginary part, and you can call it timeline if you want, and possibly it is. Yes, Michelle.
Actually, in the picture that you have drawn, there are two stationary points slightly below the maximum. As you said, there would be two trajectories that would contribute.
Yes.
And we expect that they interfere. And then, as they coalesce, we get what we usually get in semi-classical dynamics,
the rainbow.
And so rainbow is described by an airy function, and that would be the dark side of the rainbow.
Yeah.
But there should be some oscillations on the classical side.
Yes.
Are they being observed?
That's exactly what
Yes,
they are. And it's in fact, it's very easy to look at the interference of these trajectories. Even in the experiment.
Yeah.
And yes, these oscillations are observed. Beyond that, for energies higher, then you have exponential tail.
But does it fit an airy function?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Because the airy function decays faster than an exponential.
Well, this is what I was trying to remember. It's
three halves,
right? Yeah. It's an exponent of an argument, but argument is
to three halves.
Yes. Some combination of parameters to the power of three.
Yeah.